From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a millionaire in Minnesota made a rather shocking revelation. He was on food stamps. It's not that he needed SNAP benefits. The shock was that Rob Understander was able to qualify for food stamps in the first place, and Republicans in Congress grabbed onto his story to call for an overhaul to the program. And now they're getting it. The Trump administration has announced an overhaul in the eligibility rules for food stamps, or SNAP benefits. By their own estimates, more than 3 million people will lose SNAP benefits when it takes effect. But here's what critics are pointing to. As of 2017, based on federal data, only 0.2% of all SNAP benefits went to beneficiaries with net incomes above the poverty line. In other words, the story of millionaire Rob Understander was a super outlier. The program is very good at identifying who should qualify and who should not. It's better at avoiding fraud and abuse than most federal programs. And yet here we are, with the changes coming essentially by executive order. The president does not need Congress's approval on this one, or at least it appears that way. This hour, a conversation about who's eligible for SNAP, who isn't, what's changing, and who's deserving of assistance. Our guests this hour include Pete Nabosny, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. Pete, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Silva is a Community Advocacy Specialist for FoodLink. Tom, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Cool. Thank you, Evan.
And Marcia Coley is a Curbside Market Ambassador for FoodLink and someone who has benefited from SNAP benefits as well and has some stories from people in our community to share, which we will do this hour. Welcome. Thanks for being
here. Thank you.
Pete and I talked briefly about this yesterday, and one of the first things I found, Pete, in looking at the stories that kind of led up to the July announcement on this was Republicans worried about fraud, Republicans worried about abuse, and they kept pointing to this Minnesota story. But the interesting thing to me is their own data shows, look, nobody wants fraud and abuse. I mean, nobody wants that. And it's probably impossible to have a 0% fraud and abuse. But federal data at 0.2%, that's a pretty low fraud and abuse number, at least in my mind. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinarily low. If you look at the you know, the percentages of folks who misfile or commit some kind of fraud on their tax returns, that's quite a bit higher than something like that. I think there's a, you know, broadly speaking, there's this fear that exists that, you know, somewhere, somehow, somebody's getting away with something, you know, in terms of these public assistance programs. And so we orient a lot of rules around that idea to prevent a single person anywhere from taking advantage of a system in a way that we don't think is appropriate. And, you know, that while understandable, that impulse then results in lots of people who do need assistance in these programs not having it or having to jump through 1,000 hoops to prove that they should be able to receive it, which limits their ability to, you know, to whether it's escape from the cycle of poverty, you know, gain a sustaining wage. There's a lot of downfield consequences to this kind of prevailing fear that exists in many parts of the country around somebody kind of scamming the system.
Tom, how serious of an impact do you think this federal change would be if it goes through?
Yeah, if it goes through on a national level, we could have 3 million families and individuals potentially losing their SNAP benefits. And a lot of those 3 million families who are categorically eligible, which we can get into a little bit later, the exact definition, are still eligible for SNAP benefits and would just need to have their cases reprocessed. And the real damage is that the more that people need to have their cases reprocessed, the more hoops that people need to jump through to apply for a program that it's not particularly easy to apply to already. There's a lot of verifications, there's interviews, there's documents you have to provide, there's asset tests that you have to pass. A lot of these people who are still eligible, who meet the income requirements, aren't going to be able to go through that. And a lot of the human services agencies aren't going to have the capacity to reprocess those applications as well.
So in other words, it sounds like if there's one thing we've already learned in the early years of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, it's that when things are really separated and complicated for people in poverty, even if you're eligible for help with transportation, SNAP benefits, other benefits, child care, whatever the case may be, if it is complicated and burdensome, a lot of people who might be eligible are probably not going to end up with those benefits.
Yep, exactly that.
Okay, and so for you, are there any downstream effects here? I mean, why don't you give me a little overview if you think there's a cascade of possible impacts here, which we can get to later this hour.
Yeah, there's a couple of different cascading impacts that we could expect to see if people lose SNAP benefits at this level or if people think that they're going to lose SNAP benefits at this level. So to put it in context, FoodLink is the regional food bank for Rochester and the 10 surrounding areas, which means that we supply food to upwards of 200 emergency food organizations in the 10 counties around here, and we have over 500 partners otherwise who are distributing food to people. And last year, we put out about 19 million pounds of food into our community, into people's hands. And all across the country, SNAP benefits cover almost 10 times more than the total amount that food banks across the country are able to put out. So if we see a significant drop in the number of people who can access SNAP and need to shift to the emergency food sector, we're not going to have the resources to make up for all of the people who are coming in. And additionally, what the rule change that's being proposed now is going to affect families who are categorically eligible for SNAP for their participation in other government benefit programs, which makes it easier for them to apply and makes it easier for them to qualify for school meals as well. So if you're categorically eligible for SNAP, that means that you don't have to fill out a separate application to receive school meals, to receive free and reduced lunch. Taking this away would mean that parents would have to individually go through and reapply for each child in their family, and putting up that roadblock is going to make it significantly harder for them to get that free and reduced meal for the children.
What's coming up on Tuesday? What's FoodLink doing on next Tuesday?
So on Tuesday, to kind of mobilize against this rule change, we're having a press conference at FoodLink with Congressman Joe Morelli, and we're going to have members from the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative there. We're going to have members of the Children's Agenda there, and we're all going to really stand in solidarity as a community and say, this is not something that we will tolerate and that this is something that we're going to make noise about and fight back against.
In a moment, I'm going to ask Marcia Coley to not only talk about her own story, but some of the stories that FoodLink has been collecting throughout the community. But before we do that, what I want to do is kind of paint a pretty stark picture, or at least stark is maybe the wrong word, a clear picture on who is going to be impacted by this and how. And one of the things that Pete Nabosny does, I think, very well is puts data into sort of tangible terms in our community. So, you know, families of three, et cetera. And you also take a look at what we call benefits cliffs. We hear that a lot. How do you define a cliff?
Sure. So a cliff is when someone who's receiving a particular, you know, public assistance support program, whether it's, you know, Medicaid or temporary assistance or Section 8 or food stamps, when that instead of that benefit kind of slowly phasing out as their income increases, they pass a certain point with their income and then they lose the entire benefit, which is what's proposed to happen under this SNAP rule change. So currently, states have some flexibility in how they administer the SNAP program, and many states, including New York, 40 states in total, including New York, they take advantage of this to allow families who are, there's a formula that we don't need to get into, but there's a formula that calculates how much your SNAP benefit is, and it's based on childcare costs and housing and a bunch of other things. But the formula would indicate that someone would receive benefits well beyond 130% of the poverty threshold. So that's for, you know, Monroe County. Someone can go to our website. Math's a little tricky on the radio, but go to our website, thechildrensagenda.org, and read a blog post on this. So a family in Monroe County right now under certain circumstances, family of three, SNAP would phase out at $30,500 or so a year.
We're talking, so a family of three,
yeah.
Monroe County, $30,000 household income?
Yes.
Household income.
Yeah, household income, $30,500 a year. And this is with some assumptions in terms of housing costs and things like that. So that's like 144% of the poverty threshold. Under the proposed rule change, they would lose that SNAP at $27,700-some-odd. So there's a $3,000 window that's the cliff. So if they go just above that 27 some odd dollars, they go from getting, you know, $60 a month in SNAP benefits to zero, where currently it kind of phases down from that 27 to into the 30,000. So for families that are just transitioning out of poverty and they've got a little more income and they're the groups that, you know, the Poverty Initiative and others are really working with, That's a big impact. You get a slight raise or you get a few more hours and all of a sudden you lose, you know, $700 a year in SNAP benefits just because you crossed over that line. And that's in the context of there's a lot of other cliffs that families face right around that same time. So, you know, 130% is the new SNAP cliff if this goes through. 138% is the Medicaid cliff. 140-something% is Section 8. So you could earn a couple more $1,000 a year and go from, receiving quite a bit of support to receiving, you know, no support from these really critical programs. And the lived experience of that is that you actually have fewer resources. You have less money despite having gotten a raise. And so that creates a lot of really bad incentives and traps. It's, you know, people talk about it as like a poverty trap. And this proposed rule change just exacerbates that problem that families in Monroe County are already facing.
So with this cliff in particular, combined with some of the others that you talked about, if someone takes a raise, they may end up functionally with fewer dollars to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Under this and in combination with some other programs.
So a couple things come to mind. First of all, as you say, it's a bad incentive. You don't want someone sitting there going, I don't know if I should even take this raise or take this job, because we may be worse off, which is bad enough. But that assumes that people are aware of everything that would be on the table. I mean, is it conceivable, Pete, that someone would get a 50-cent-an-hour raise or whatever the case is, not even realizing that, oops, now you've got zero SNAP benefits coming?
Yeah, it's certainly conceivable. I'm not sure how many people are tracking, you know, federal rule changes as they're going through, although we're trying to get the word out around this. I actually think that a lot of folks, you know, who I've spoken to who are experiencing these systems, they are incredibly savvy and know where these cliffs exist and you know, there's a lot of awareness of them, but it's a lot of math that goes into all that. So a lot of times folks they'll kind of make a guess around some of this and you know, it's an educated guess around certain income levels, but the idea that someone would turn down a raise or additional hours in particular to avoid losing these benefits it's really running contrary to all of our public policy emphasis on getting folks to a more sustaining wage. So it's just incredibly counterproductive to have these kinds of sharp phase outs and cliffs in our social safety net.
I know Tom wants to jump in, but just to kind of put a fine point on that, it is typically, and again, I'm going to generalize here, but it's typically people in this country who are more conservative politically, who are more adamantly calling for getting people to work, getting people off of government assistance in some way. And this policy that comes from an ostensibly conservative administration may actually incentivize keeping people on assistance.
It could, yeah. I mean, I think that's... you know, we think a lot about it's a possible outcome, and obviously different folks will kind of interpret things in different ways and make plans for their family. But it would stand to reason that these cliffs, people are going to avoid them where they can. And so, yeah, again, I think it's really kind of productive. And just like taking a big picture, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of conversation around like tax policy and like the you know, we have marginal tax rates that go up, you know, after you earn $250,000 a year. And there's a concern that folks will, you know, and this is often a conservative, you know, talking point that will, you know, they'll be less entrepreneurial if their tax rate is higher and things like that. But if you think about it from the other side, from folks that are, you know, low income and, you know, struggling to make it week to week, the idea that, you know, you'd actually earn less money, you'd have less resources if you earn more money is, I mean, it's just mind-boggling that that's the way our public policies are oriented currently, and this rule would just, again, worsen that problem for lots of folks in this community.
Tom, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Pete put a really fine point on the income limits that are part of this rule change that are going to affect, I think it's estimated New York State Hunger Solutions estimated upwards of 87,000 New Yorkers could be affected just by the income limits. But the other piece of it is also a change to the asset eligibility for qualifying for SNAP benefits. So you can't make over a certain amount. Getting just up to that tiny little raise that you could get could put you back $70 a month. But the other piece is that currently categorical eligibility is used by 40 states, including New York, to raise the amount of assets that a SNAP household is allowed to have in their bank account, in their name, and still receive benefits. And the point of doing this is to allow families to have more than $1,000, more than $2,000 in their savings account, allow families to have a car that is valued at over $2,500, things along those lines, so that they can have build an actual savings account for themselves and not have to spend their savings almost all the way down before they qualify for government programs. Because if we want to use SNAP to be able to help people get self-sufficient, that means we have to allow people to be able to save their income, allow people to have things like a vehicle to get to the further out jobs that are going to be in the suburbs around Rochester. And categorical eligibility allows them to have that savings net now. And eliminating that rule would have people spend down their savings before they would be able to get this benefit.
Before I was kind of digging into some of the particulars here, and this is what Tom and Pete and people like Marcia understand so much better than I do. This is what you do in terms of policy and understanding it. But the notion of spending down savings to be eligible is not something that was really on my radar. That is stark here. And so that's another possible outcome here. Spending down savings to get to a certain threshold so you become eligible probably flies in the face of so much of what we talk about of financial security, planning, et cetera. So these are some of the impacts of policy. And listeners, if you want to call the program as we talk about SNAP benefits, we talk about who's eligible, who's not, and what comes next, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. If you want to share your story or your thoughts, you can email us as well, connections@WXXI.org. And if you want to share your own personal experience, I mean, people go through a lot of different phases in life, and maybe you've had to make some hard decisions or thought about where certain cliffs are, et cetera. So I want to talk to Marcia Coley, first of all, about your own experience in benefiting from SNAP. What did it do for you?
Well, what it did for me, I had two small children, and I was working, and I got custody of two of my grandchildren. So that's when the SNAP benefits came in. And so it did help because there were extra children in the house, and I had to spend more money out of my paycheck every week to take care of my kids. So the SNAP benefits were beneficial, where that made it easier and more affordable to buy the different foods and things that I needed to take care of my family at that time. So, and plus I know people who still benefit from the SNAP program. And it's so helpful because I see it kind of slows down the time that they have to go to a food bank to get more food to fill out the rest of the month. They have the SNAP benefits. They can go and buy food, save some of their SNAP benefits, go through the month, and still be able to keep food in the house to feed their children. Along with the school lunch program, I think it's just horrible to think that if this was proposed, that this came through, that these children would not get some, not get a school lunch. Some kids don't even, that would be their only meal for the day, you know, in some households. So I think it's just horrible to think that politicians can do this to the community, to people in the community.
How easy or not, how was it functionally to use SNAP?
It was easy to use. The only process that was kind of, I wouldn't say difficult, but time-consuming, was at the beginning when you apply and all the things that you have to bring in, all the paperwork and assets. Before I had custody of my two grandchildren, I didn't have SNAP because my income was enough to take care of me and my kids, my two kids. So when that came along, all the different paperwork that I had to bring, all my assets, bank accounts, I had a car, I had to show the value of the car and everything. So all that was required to get the SNAP benefits for my grandkids, and my income was included, which I thought at that time, I said, why would my income be included? You know, because I'm already taking care of my two kids and my household. But that was the rules and regulations to receive SNAP benefits and benefits for my grandkids.
So it was pretty thorough.
Yeah, very thorough.
Which goes to the point about just how rare, and again, federal data as reported by Vox, as of 2017, only 0.2% of all SNAP benefits went to beneficiaries with net incomes above the poverty line. And Marcia's story, I think, Tom, illustrates, yeah, it may seem onerous up front, but it seemed to have been working.
Yeah, absolutely. The process that we have right now for people to apply for SNAP benefits has a lot of rigor to it, and it takes into account a lot of different things that make it so that by the time you get to the point of receiving your EBT card in the mail and receiving your monthly balance, there are places, there are stores, there are farmers markets, there are curbside markets that you can go to and spend those benefits down as well. So yeah, it's not a you just show up at the human services office and five right. minutes later you walk out with something to spend on grocery dollars. It I can speak personally from my own experience applying for SNAP benefits several years ago, but it took me several months to get the correct appointments with DHS to make sure that we were able to make the appointments, and then there were some administrative delay, and it went almost 3 months from the point that I applied to the point that I actually received SNAP benefits because they were tracking and making sure that I had all of my documentation submitted correctly.
So, Marcia, you've been now working to collect some stories and some mm-hmm. feedback from people in our community. You want to share some of that?
Sure. All right, this is from one person. They said, this would do way more harm than good. Some children need these programs to be successful in school, and working families need these programs to help feed their families and to provide for them. Another comment, I oppose the severe restrictions of broad-based categorical eligibility because it could hurt many families that already struggle to put food on the table. Some people can go hungry, struggling just for the next meal. I feel like they should lower the requirements due to the fact that there's already so many families and people who depend on those services to survive their everyday lives. So making it harder would just make more starving families. So these are some of the comments.
Those are some of the comments that you're receiving from people right here in our own community.
Yes.
People are worried about it. Tom, what kind of feedback are you hearing so far? I mean, how deeply concerned are you hearing people are?
Yeah, we're hearing a lot of feedback from peer organizations, both locally and nationally, that people are really concerned that this is something that could actually go through. And people are concerned about losing SNAP. People are concerned about losing school meals. But really, we're also concerned at just the tenor and the boldness that this administration has taken towards government programs and specifically programs that people use to feed themselves. So within the last year, we've seen regulations come on about receiving SNAP benefits for people who might be considered a public charge. We've seen different rule changes to make the already stringent work requirements for SNAP even more strict. And we've seen proposals floated to convert SNAP benefits entirely into a prepackaged food box by USDA Commodities. So it's part of a really disturbing trend to really dismantle the effectiveness of these programs to lift people out of poverty.
Pete, as someone who works in policy, and you understand there's a lot of different motivations and a lot of different possible motivations, I don't know if it's fair to ask you this, but I do want to ask you what you think the motivation is to make these cuts. If the rate of fraud and abuse is low, what do you think the motivating force is in the Trump administration to make these cuts?
Well, it's tough to say. It's tough to see what's in someone's brain. I think there is a prevailing or a strongly held belief that a lot of people have that too many people are receiving public assistance and that there's that these programs discourage, despite the fact what all the things I talked about earlier in terms of benefit cliffs and there's this idea out there that a lot of these public assistance programs together discourage people from working and work is a central value in America. It's something that our public assistance, our safety net programs are heavily oriented around. If you're going to receive cash assistance, you have to go through all of these kind of work experiences and short-term job training programs because you shouldn't be receiving benefits if you're getting an associate's degree or something like that. There's a lot of policies around all these different areas that focus on the immediate need for folks to work. And there's a belief, I think, that when taken together, all of these programs, they keep people in poverty and that they and that instead of encouraging people to work, they're encouraging people to just become dependent on the state for support. And that's something that, it's understandable people want to reduce. But I think most of the evidence shows that these programs, they're already pretty strict, as we're seeing with this discussion around SNAP, and that a lot of these efforts to just force people into the workforce without really meeting their basic needs and helping support them for housing and childcare, and they just don't work. They may work in the real short term, but most studies show that over the long run, families' basic needs need to be met for them to work their way out of poverty and to have a kind of a sustaining wage and existence in society.
Well, I've got some emails to read from listeners, which I'll do after the break. And that offers, I think, some insight into how some critics of SNAP, for example, view the program. And we'll do that after our only break of the hour. Listeners, as we talk about the Trump administration's proposal to cut SNAP benefits for more than 3 million Americans, if you want to weigh in, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And you can keep the email coming at connections@WXXI.org. Pete Nabosny is policy director at the Children's Agenda. Tom Silva is a community advocacy specialist for FoodLink. Marcia Coley is a curbside market ambassador. And let's go ahead and take that only break, and your feedback is next. Coming up in our second hour, it's the summer of food on Connections, and we examine Rochester's growing food truck scene. The National Chamber of Commerce Foundation finds that food trucks are about a $3 billion national enterprise annually. But cities have a wide range of rules. In some cities, it's really hard to get a food truck on the road. Other cities, it's not. So how does Rochester rank? We examine it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. John writes to us to say, Evan, I'm sorry, but we've seen enough exposés on food stamps to know how that money is often spent. You've seen what these people buy, and there should be limitations and restrictions. And yes, the Trump administration's right. Fewer people on food stamps is a worthwhile goal. John in Rochester. Let's do a couple of things here. Let's hit the first question on his first point, what people on food stamps are buying with food stamps. Tom, you've heard the criticism. Mm-hmm. What would you say to John?
Yeah, I would say two things. There's the kind of micro level, different anecdotes, examples, exposés that you see, and there's the macro level data that you can look at. And the macro level data shows, like we said, that low level of fraud. And the macro data also shows that the purchasing habits of households with SNAP benefits and SNAP and households without SNAP benefits are almost identical. When you look at the top 10 items that households using SNAP benefits to buy their groceries using and households using other means of income to buy their groceries, the top 10 list is exactly the same. There's a couple of things in different order. I think maybe milk comes before juice for one of those groups, but it's almost exactly the same by volume, by category.
In other words, Americans tend to eat crappy, unhealthy processed foods, but we're upset if people use taxpayer dollars to do that. I guess. Is that, Pete, is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I think there's a, you know, I think what John's indicating, I think, is, you know, it's broadly held that that if you're poor, if you're receiving government assistance, you shouldn't be able to make choices with what food to buy, and it's okay for wealthier folks to have, you know, meat and seafood, and, you know, we always hear about steak and lobsters, is that's what people point to, but as Tom said, the data doesn't show that that's what's happening. Yes, I'm sure out there are some people that occasionally buy steak and lobsters with their SNAP, just as there are plenty of people with more resources that maybe they can't afford it either. I mean, people are gonna, you know, buy different things, but in the aggregate, it's just it's a level of kind of paternalism, I think, that we should be controlling the individual food choices that people have. I get it. It's public dollars and things like that, but orienting these programs around, first of all, that's not what this is meant to, this proposal is meant to cut. So we should just be clear there.
Right. John's criticism is not directly related, though the last half of his email, which we can hit again, but the point is, but go ahead.
Yeah, that there's, you know, there's different bills. There's been one introduced in New York several times to kind of limit what's called luxury food items like steak and lobsters and junk food and things like that.
Junk food like soda.
Yeah. And it should be, it's important to note there are things that that you're not allowed to buy with SNAP right now. You can't buy alcohol. You can't buy tobacco. You can't buy pet food. You can't buy soap. You can't buy toiletries, which is a concern a lot of people have. I mean, you know, people need those things too. But you can't buy hot food, you know, that's already been cooked with your SNAP benefits. So there are some restrictions, but there's just this intense focus on a couple outlier cases of folks that may be using the system in ways that other people don't think is appropriate. And then there's that belief that we should orient all of our public policies around those kind of outlier cases.
You use the word paternalism. Do you think that there is a view of worthiness or unworthiness?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's embedded in all of our you know, public assistance policies. I think there's this sense that certain people should be able to get public assistance and others shouldn't. And you know, I think it's impossible not to talk about race when we talk about that issue. I think, you know, going back to you know, President Reagan's administration and talk around welfare queens and things like that, there was a demonization of people of color for using these programs and wildly inflated statistics in terms of how these programs were being used. And I think that that also gets embedded into the conversation itself when we, you know, we don't like the choices that some other people may make. You know, I think it's more than unfortunate, but it's a reality of how we orient our public assistance programs in this country.
Marcia, what, generally speaking, well, hold on. I'm going to ask you a question first. I was going to ask you what you were using food stamps on. Do you think it's my business to ask you?
It depends on the reason why you're.
Because I'm not even sure it is, actually. Like, I was about to ask you, and yeah. I don't really. Like, I don't even know if I feel like I have any business asking you what you were spending SNAP benefits on when you were in charge caring for your two grandchildren on top of your two children. But some people do feel like it's their business because it's at least partially their tax dollars. What do you say to that?
I don't have a problem with that. Okay. I'm transparent. I have nothing to hide or any reason to have a disagreement about it. What I spent it on was food, fruits, vegetables, meats, and cereal, milk, you know, the necessity things to keep my family healthy and filled, you know, so that they could concentrate on not their stomach grumbling, because something that never happened in my family, which all my children can contest to, is they don't know what a missed meal cramp is. So therefore, they had plenty of food. They had healthy snacks, because one thing that my children that I didn't believe in giving them was candy. They would get that on holidays and sparsely, like Easter or Christmas. Fruit was the biggest thing that I kept in my house, on my table, in my refrigerator for the kids to eat. So, yes, the SNAP benefits helped a lot because I could purchase more fruit, more produce, and I believed in greens and carrots and potatoes and would cook up massive meals because my kids ate really, really, really big. So I needed the SNAP benefits that, along with my cash that I was making in my paycheck every day. So it just boosted it even more so. So I had that food, enough food and thing to last for the whole month into the next month before I would be able to use my SNAP benefits again when I was eligible the time to get them. So yes, I spent money, the SNAP benefits and my money on food and healthy foods for my children and myself.
Pete Nabowski, you want to add to that?
Yeah, just to put a little data behind that, the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out kind of what consumers spend money on, and they break it down into a bunch of different category areas. And low-income households, folks who qualify for SNAP, who could qualify for SNAP, I should say, it's not whether or not they're actually receiving it, you know, they spend more money on fruits and vegetables each month than they do on like beef and seafood. And I think it's fine for folks to be buying both, but it's just this narrative doesn't match the data that we have at all, you know, and I think it's unfortunate. The other point I just like to make, it's a broader problem with a lot of these, the different ways that we handle public assistance programs. If you set a whole bunch of rules here and a whole bunch of rules there, and you say you can only use this for that and this other thing for this sort of thing, it just, you know, the purpose of these programs is to support families, to allow them to live a fulfilling life, to get out of poverty, to be able to participate in the workforce and to provide for themselves and their family. And every one of these little additional rules that we place and restrictions and eligibility criteria and hoops that we have to jump through, it all makes it harder to achieve the thing that we say we're trying to do with the program. So, you know, I get the impulse that people have around, you know, public dollars, and we want to make sure that everything's being spent according to whatever someone's personal beliefs dictate. But those things can often be very counterproductive when taken as a whole with everything else that a low-income person has to deal with to just navigate through their day. And I think if we take a step back and think about what are the purpose of these programs and what are we trying to achieve with them, I think we'd realize that we're adding just so much complexity and difficulty to the lives of people who are already struggling to get by.
And just so we're kind of clear on the difference between people losing SNAP based on new hoops to jump through versus losing SNAP based on eligibility. Do we know, Tom, that 3.1 million or so people that the Trump administration is estimating are not going to get SNAP benefits? Is that 3.1 million Americans who would not be eligible anymore? Because if that is the case, then I think the number has to be much larger than that if it's also going to be more onerous just to get them if you are eligible.
Yeah, this is another good reason to oppose this rule change, really, about the spending of public dollars, because of those 3.1 million or so people who could be affected by this rule change, we actually suspect, and data seems to be showing, that most of those people will remain eligible. And they are going to be affected because it's eliminating their categorical eligibility, meaning that their eligibility in other programs allowed them to be eligible for SNAP, which allowed them to be eligible for school meals without having to fill out additional paperwork. So to put it in some local context for us, in Monroe County, about 113,000 residents receive SNAP benefits in some form or another. And according to the local Human Services Office, about 17,000 SNAP cases that are currently open are open due to this categorical eligibility rule, that if this rule change went through, our local Human Services Office would have to put all of their time and energy into reevaluating every one of those 17,000 cases, the majority of which are probably still eligible, to seeing if they can keep receiving SNAP benefits or not. So the real drag on taxpayers is going to be the amount of time that it's going to take to recertify all of these families. And then something that's called churn within the social services, when somebody is on a program and then they become ineligible for just a month or a couple of months, mm-hmm. and then immediately get back eligible, which pulls more time away from the agency to process all of these new cases. So this rule as it stands right now makes it easier for people to apply and makes it less expensive for human services agencies to administer these dollars so that there's less overhead, which a lot of people talk about, and more money going directly to people's pockets.
Herman writes to us to say, tying today's program with a discussion regarding demagogues, cherry-picking a rare exception and amplifying it to mislead the public into thinking something is widespread for the purpose of a political agenda is a favorite tactic of demagogues. It reminds me, Herman says, of Reagan's trumpeting of welfare queens. As you said, the SNAP program has an extremely low rate of fraud. Similarly, propaganda has succeeded in convincing large numbers of Americans that there is widespread voter fraud in a drive to justify voter suppression tactics like voter ID laws, when in fact voter fraud is extremely rare. End quote. So that last point, Herman's right about voter fraud is extremely rare, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. Pete, do you think there is a larger point there about trying to take outlier cases and drum up public concern that isn't sort of statistically representative?
Yeah, I mean, I think the data is pretty clear that whether it's the millionaire who figures out how to, you know, receive SNAP to prove a point, or some of these other, you know, examples around, you know, steak and lobsters and things like that. I think there's an effort to use a couple anecdotes to inform, you know, broader public policies. And I get it. People work by way of example. Like we internalize things that we see in our everyday lives. We use leaps of logic to think things through a lot. But if we try to take a step back and think about, again, what these programs are intended to do and what the data shows us, we can get away from that kind of thinking. And I think that's why we're here today. That's why our organizations have been advocating around this. And I would note, and we haven't really touched on it yet, that the public comment period for this is open right now. So folks should, they can go to our website. I think they can go to FoodLink's website to find where they can comment, to oppose this rule or to say you think this following change should happen with it. There are opportunities for folks to make their voice heard and to show that there's a lot of people in this country that are very concerned about about this issue and not just pay attention to a couple outlier cases.
So again, where can people do that?
They could go to the childrensagenda.org or foodlinkny.org.
Yep.
And we have resources there that can point you to some of our partners in, at the state and federal levels are organizing sign-ons. You could also go directly to the USDA website and find it through there, but they don't always make it the easiest place to find. So check out our websites and you can learn
more. I confess I would be surprised if what's coming isn't some version of the following. Public outcry, Congressman Morelli comes, he's preaching to a choir on Tuesday of people who already agree with him. Republicans in Congress will say things like, we care about all people, we want opportunity for all, we just want to root out fraud and abuse, we feel like this will tighten the system better. They're not going to listen to an hour of Connections and Pete Nabosny and Tom Silva and Marcia Coley. The changes will probably go through. That's probably what's going to – that's really fatalistic, but is that what's going to happen, Tom?
Well, the sneakier thing about it is nobody in Congress needs to actually say anything about it, because when the Farm Bill was reauthorized earlier this year, they tried to include variations of this change. They tried to include variations of work requirements, and they couldn't get it to go through. So the Farm Bill went through with, you know, changes here and there, but mostly unchanged in the administration of SNAP. So what they're trying to do is use these non-legislative things that don't have to be voted on, these rule changes that are pretty much just executive power through Sonny Perdue at the USDA, to make this change. So probably the fatalistic timeline is that they put this change out, and regardless of how many comments they got nearly 300,000 comments, overwhelmingly negative, about the public charge rule change from last year, and they're implementing it starting this fall. The optimistic thing that we're hoping for is, frankly, that there just isn't actually enough capacity or interest at the USDA in rolling this out, because the local Department of Human Services offices that would have to recertify all of these cases don't want to recertify all of these cases. Everybody knows that this is going to take resources ultimately away from the government and away from the families. And the hope is that this is just a tactic to rile up the base.
Let me read a little bit more feedback. Paul says, more than 1 in 7 county residents receives food assistance. When I was growing up, my family suddenly found ourselves in need of, quote, food stamps, as my mom went to school for job training. We would not have had a career without that help. Paid back more in taxes over decades than we received in benefits. That's from Paul. Dr. Elizabeth Murray says, you can't buy diapers either with SNAP benefits. It's mind-boggling that we could save money by streamlining how services are offered, but many do not accept this concept because, quote, what if someone games the system, end quote. Diapers as well is on the list of can't buy. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Marcia, yeah. Did that make it more of a pain for a mother and a grandmother like you trying to figure out, well, I can use SNAP for this, but I guess even though I'm at the store here, I can't get soap, I can't get toiletries, I can't get diapers.
Well, that was what my cash money was about. And that's what I used for those items that I couldn't get with SNAP, because SNAP was just for food items. So that was fine with me. I worked it out.
You worked it out. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Pete, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the dance a lot of people do. They figure out what can qualify under SNAP, which is, you know, most food items, and then what cash resources they have, they purchase those other items. The challenge is things like diapers, as a parent with a 2-year-old, they're incredibly expensive. And so people with you know, less means, they struggle to, you know, to have those items. And, you know, I've spoken to folks that it can be really challenging because if you're receiving public assistance and you get your SNAP and your public assistance check at the beginning of the month, and at the end of the month you need toilet paper or you need soap or something like that, and you do have some SNAP left over, let's say, but you had to spend your cash assistance earlier in the month on whatever, then, you know, you're doing this dance. And so so I think there are ways, you know, I agree with Dr. Murray there, that we should be kind of thinking about streamlining these programs and you know, integrating them together to allow families to make the right choices to meet their needs. But there's definitely some big holes, particularly when it comes to things like sanitation, you know, sanitary products and things like that, that aren't covered under different programs.
So let me give you a softball.
Let's hear it.
Let's talk about streamlining. Does it make sense to just give people money?
Well, Evan, you ask me that nearly every time I come on the air here. There is a lot of evidence, and you could go back in the archives, I guess, and listen to our earlier shows. There's a lot of evidence in the U.S. and elsewhere that the unconditional cash assistance, saying we trust you and your family to make the right choices for what you need, whether it's diapers or these kinds of food products or whatever else, you know, to use the money to pay for your rent or to, you know,
get to work
or whatever it is, that's more effective than these kind of tightly tailored, you know, a multitude of different assistance programs.
A voucher for this, restrictions here.
And there's a lot of evidence that fewer conditions on assistance, you know, results in better long-term outcomes for parents and for children. I think it's really important to note for young children, especially cash assistance programs, unconditional programs, they lead to better school readiness, you know, higher rates of high school graduation, all sorts of things down the road.
Here's why I asked that, because you kind of smiled and you said, you asked me that almost every time I'm here. And I almost noted an eye roll from you at that. I hope not.
Yeah.
But here's why I asked, because we have been talking about that for years, but there is more of a national conversation, some of it driven by presidential candidates. I'm curious to know if you think there is any momentum for that kind of benefit, direct cash assistance, as opposed to these much more specifically earmarked vouchers, benefits, et cetera, with limitations. Is there any momentum, do you think, on the policy level for that at any level of government? And do you think there is any coalescing viewpoint among policy directors, economists, et cetera?
I think there's some. There's been increased conversation at the federal level and elsewhere over the last few years. As you indicated, it's part of the presidential campaigns. I think there's a greater likelihood of something happening for specific subsets of the population. For example, there's a couple bills at the federal level that have a lot of co-sponsors to basically do what a lot of other countries do, which is a child allowance, to say if you have, you know, children, particularly young children in your household, you have a lot of additional expenses. Here's some unconditional assistance to help you meet the needs of your family. That's, I think, much more likely than something like a UBI at this point. A universal basic income, it's generating more attention. It's not particularly popular among the broader public. I think some of this conversation around worthiness comes into play with that. But for specific populations, especially children, I think there's a recognition that what a lot of families need, families with children, to support themselves, is they just need more money. And so a really effective way to do that is something like a child allowance, where you'd get and again, lots of other countries do this, and it results in really positive outcomes for kids, where they just get, you know, a check every month or every quarter to help them meet the expenses of having kids.
All right. Sarah says, listening late here, but does any of this affect school lunches? Let's just talk a little bit about that cascade effect. If you missed it earlier, listeners like Sarah, I'm going to turn it over to Tom Silva there. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. It has the potential to affect school lunches. And the way that it works right now is that these 3 million individuals and families that are being talked about are categorically eligible to receive SNAP benefits based on their eligibility for other programs like TANF, like housing vouchers. And because of their eligibility there, they have an easier time enrolling in SNAP without duplicative paperwork, and an easier time enrolling in these school meal programs without duplicative paperwork. So the issue is less that these families are no longer going to be eligible for the program. Mm-hmm. Many of them are still going to income qualify. The issue is now that they're not categorically eligible, now that they have to fill out separate applications, now that they have to fill out things in duplicate, now that they have to rely on the school and the school district and the human services office to separately coordinate with the individual parents and families, that a lot of kids are going to fall through the cracks on this in a school lunch system that already is really tenuously working for a lot of kids. We're pretty lucky here in New York State to have a very good school meal program, but I think I was reading something recently about a consideration in New Jersey for cutting kids off if they had a lunch debt greater than $20. So it has a cascading effect across the country on school meals.
Marcia Coley, what do you think people who are trying to either make policy or people who have never needed SNAP benefits, what do you think people misunderstand?
They misunderstand that when you're a single parent, say, and you're raising your children, doing the best that you can to raise your children, and you have morals, and you're instilling them in your children, and to Yes, we run into tight times, and just to be able to know that you can, not depend, but can look forward to some kind of small amount of help to make you help you to get through the rough patches in your daily life, and especially with the school lunch programs, with SNAP being a part of that. I look at families that have like 5-6 kids or more, and I know, and the parent is working. It may be two parents, it may be just be one parent, and they're working a job. They're coming home every day and then still feeding their children. Being able to do that is a plus, and it makes the family feel as though they're worth something, instead of just, you know, having to go from hand to mouth or not at all. And so people need to understand that not everybody has a $600,000 a year job, but there are people that are doing the best that they can and that they know how to, and not just sitting around waiting for a handout. These are people that are working, even though they may be working for minimum wage, but they're working and doing the best they can to take care of their families. And they're teaching their children that not to sit around, to get a job, to work, mm-hmm. to improve your life. We may be doing okay now, but you can look forward to doing better. And this is a way to help boost that up, to help push it through.
I'm grateful that you're here to
thank you.
Share your own story about the work you're doing now.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
One more time, Pete Nabosny, where should people learn more and maybe react if they want to make their voice heard about the SNAP?
Sure, they can go to our website where we have some resources at thechildrensagenda.org, and they can also go to FoodLink's website at foodlinkny.org, and we'll point you to many other places that you can find additional resources.
Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda. Thanks for being here, Pete.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Silva as well from FoodLink, and again, they've got an event with Congressman Morelli coming up on Tuesday.
Yep, look out for the news after Tuesday, September 3rd. It's going to be at 1 p.m. at FoodLink with Congressman Morelli in unity with a lot of other organizations in Rochester.
Thanks to you, too. Thank you, Tom. Short break, more connections coming up.